Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. As we prepare to say goodbye to 2016, we're taking a look back at some of the year's highs and lows. Chefs Cody and Samantha Carroll of Hot Tails and Sacolet have had quite a year. They traveled all the way to Tokyo to cook up some authentic Louisiana gumbo. They join us with tales of that challenging experience. Then, we remember the passing of Edgar Dookie Chase, the patriarch of the Chase family. His wife of 70 years, Leah Chase, shares memories of her husband, his life as a musician, and the quiet role he played behind the scenes in the civil rights movement and making the restaurant the landmark establishment it is today. Then, award-winning sommelier Molly Wismeyer joins us to end our year with a celebratory exploration of champagne. We're taking a look back while toasting all that is to come on this week's Louisiana Eats. The city of New Orleans lost a legend this year with the passing of Edgar Dookie Chase, Jr. Co-proprietor of the dining landmark Dookie Chase's Restaurant, his impact was felt in the culinary world, the civil rights movement, and the music community. Perhaps most significant was his impact on his family and his wife of 70 years, Leah Chase. We sat down with Leah at Dookie Chase's restaurant to discuss Dookie's life and legacy and the role he played in making Leah Chase the icon she is today.
When I met Dookie, well, you know he was with the music. He was a musician. And the funny thing about it is I never liked musicians. Well, he met me at a dance. He was up on the stage directing his band. And he told everybody, I'm going to dance with that girl. They said, are you not? She's going to dance with you. So, sure enough, and then I came around and met his mother, and we could relate to the families were almost all alike. You know, all the so-called Creoles of color lived almost the same kind of life. You know, they worked every day, they cooked, they sewed, and that's what I did, sewed more than cooked. I didn't start cooking until I came in this restaurant. So, and it went on from there, and then we got married.
How did Mr. Chase ask you to marry him? You've never told me this before.
No, I never did, because it was just, you know, back in those days, you didn't have all the formality that you have today. You just know, well, we're going to get married. So we just went off and got married, you know. And that was so funny because he was only 18 years old and I was 23. Here we go off and get married. And when we come back, everybody said, oh, told my mother-in-law, this girl is just going to ruin your business. But my mother-in-law she wasn't like that. She was a nice lady and she really was. She loved this business. And she always said, Leah, you're just like me. What she meant was our lifestyles were like. She loved this business, I loved this business. She truly loved her husband, and I truly loved Dookie. Then his daddy died. His daddy was a young man. His daddy was only 57 years old.
Wow.
And when Dookie died, when Big Dookie died, well, my mother-in-law had nobody else. So he had to come in here and work.
He didn't really have a choice. It was what he had to do.
He had no choice. It's what he had to do. And I always felt sorry for Dookie because If you live your life and you're doing something you don't like to do, that's not happiness at all. But he did it.
But he did it for the family. He did it for his mother.
The family was big for him. And he did it for the family, and he did it well.
Well, I never knew that he ever worked behind the bar here.
He was a good bartender, and I didn't drink a thing. Never drank and never smoked. And I think that's why he couldn't relate to that music world. Because when he got it, as much as he loved it, he knew the life of a musician was not easy. It is not an easy life. Particularly in the days that he came through, it was a hard life, a rough life. He used to sit right here and wait for people to come in, and they would talk, and he would talk about his music. He would sing to them and play his music. Then he ran this, he took a course by mail from Cornell University. Learn how to manage this business, learn all that. Then he went off to promoting bands. He had top-notch musicians. They went with King Cole, Lionel Hampton, Duke Ellington. They went with big bands. I'll never forget, he was the first one in 1953, the first African-American promoter to go into the municipal auditorium.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It was segregation, so blacks couldn't sit with whites, and blacks couldn't sit downstairs. We had to always sit upstairs at the auditorium. So now he had sold out all upstairs and nothing downstairs. And he was about to lose his $5,000, and you know, with Dookie, that wasn't going too well. He didn't want to lose that money. So overnight, the whites stood behind the tickets. They sold the whole show out. We had to put people on the stage in the show, biggest show of 1951. People didn't know that because he was so low-key about what he did and how he did it. He used to work for the NAACP at that time. He would go all down in the Ninth Ward, get members. We got to have everybody join the NAACP. Work with Thurgood Marshall, work with a man from here named Nathaniel Bird, Dutch Morial, A.P. Turo, all those people, Ernest Wright. But, you know, he just did what he had to do.
But he was then responsible, I believe, for all of the people, the politicians, the members of the NAACP, the people who were moving to end segregation.
He was
the one gathering them here.
He would gather them here. King, I'll never forget. See, that's when I used to go home at night. He would bring King in here. They would come in here at night, talk to Dookie. There was a man named Jim Dombrowski. He was an old guy who went to the Highlander School in Tennessee. And the Highlander School would train people to be nonviolent protesters. So I met Jim Dombrowski, and Dookie met him by working with the sugar workers here. I remember Domino Sugar. They met upstairs to form unions for these sugar workers, and that was Jim Dombrowski's thing.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown.
You know, when I came along, this is not what I came to do. I came to push him up and ride his coattail. But it didn't work that way, Poppy. See, his daddy would go out here, his mother would push and do this. That's what I thought he would do. But he wasn't that way. So I had to push out. I had to go push out, do what I had to do to make it.
Come writers and critics, prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the again.
And his thing was always to take care of his family. His whole thing was, after he got so sick, was to be sure he left me and his children without any debt. That was his big thing. Now, you know, I'm a different kind of person. I could owe the world. And whoever pay for it, pay for it. Not Dookie. Not Dookie. He was always there to say, look, now you can't spend this money. You can't do this. And that's going to be one thing I'm going to miss. Because he kept everything in order. Everything straightened out.
You all were married for 70 years.
70 years. 70 years we lived with people who said we were not going to make it.
What was the secret to that 70-year marriage?
The hardest thing about making a marriage work is women have to be almost superwomen, Poppy. Everybody can't do that, and every man is not going to be the same way. Dookie was a good man, easy man, and you know, but I never tried to run over him. I never did that. As many awards as I get, and he was appreciative of it, but I never tried to overpower him. If you're a woman that has to go out front like I had to do to hold this business together, to make this business move, if he wasn't outgoing, then I had to be outgoing. You might not think that, man, like people who never saw Dookie, you know, and I used to kid about that. Well, they say, well, Leah, why is always Dookie's name here? I said, look, I'm not stupid, you know. Dookie's name stay up there where all the bills go to Dookie. He pay all the bills. They don't come to Leah. He pay
all the bills. Love, Louis Wayne.
Oh, the day after Mr. Chase passed, I knew just where you'd be.
Right in
the
kitchen. When I lost Emily. Emily died at about 1 o'clock in the morning. I had to open this place up, so I came in here. When my mother died, I had to open this place up. When Dookie died, I had to open this place up. That's not easy.
No.
It's not easy.
It keeps you going.
But it keeps me going. So I'm going to keep working. That's what I have to do for Dookie. I have to keep working for my children. I have to keep working for the city I live in. And I hope Dookie will look down on me and say, well, honey, you're doing it. You're making it work.
Louis Wayne. To the above. Right away.
Leah Chase of Dookie Chase Restaurant.
Let the heaven.
When we return from a short break, Samantha and Cody Carroll of Sacolet and Hot Tails joins us to talk about their most exciting moment in 2016, the surreal experience of making gumbo in Japan. Stay tuned.
My mother,
she had to buy, so
she had to buy.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street.
I'm Cody Carroll with Hot Tails Restaurant New Roads and Sacolet Restaurant in New Orleans.
And I'm Samantha Carroll, Cody's wife and co-owner of Hot Tails and Sacolet, and also the boss.
Cajun chefs are notorious for cooking just about anywhere, from the fish camp on the bayou to church picnics to backyard boils. Cody and Samantha Carroll, the chef owners of Hot Tails and Sacolet restaurants, recently found themselves in a particularly challenging place, even for a Cajun chef, Japan. Here's Cody and Samantha to explain the many obstacles they faced preparing a real Louisiana gumbo for conventioneers in Tokyo.
When they had the IPW conference here, IPW, it's a big group. It's tourism companies from all over the world. And they had a big hoopla.
Travel agents.
Yeah, travel agents, different things like that. They had a big party that the lieutenant governor and his office put on. And it was at the Superdome. So we cooked for that. And the president of JATA, which is this huge Japanese travel agent group, was there. And he invited the lieutenant governor back to Japan, come to JATA. Well, then the floods happened. And the lieutenant governor couldn't make it. But he was like, you know what? I'm going to send some chefs. So we got the call.
From the U.S. Embassy.
Yeah, the U.S. Yeah. Embassy. So we packed our stuff. We worked with them. We cooked 3 days at the JATA convention and made seafood gumbo. And then
we had to teach them how to do it.
We had to teach them how to do it as well. We had to teach two different restaurants or caterers how to make gumbo. It was really teaching the chefs how to make a roux and not be scared of it. Whenever we went to this first restaurant, they brought us in and they were so nervous to meet us. And we walk upstairs and then they walk out this gumbo and they're so nervous. They're like shaking their hands, placing it down in front of us. And we're
and
like,
what
calm
did it
down.
Look like? What did it look like?
It didn't.
Oh, it was so bad.
It didn't quite
bad,
look like gumbo.
Was, you could, all right, we could literally see every ingredient in it. It was in a clear broth.
Oh, so it was like a miso soup with gumbo ingredients extended.
It's exactly what it looked like, except the broth was, it was actually kind of thick.
Yeah.
But it was clear.
You can tell they made a roux.
We actually had two translators, and I was telling them to tell the chef that everything's perfect as far as how they cooked the shrimp and the okra and everything else, but what happened with the roux?
Yeah.
And I said, was he scared? Asked me if he was scared to make it brown. And they asked me, he was like, yeah, I was scared I was going to burn it. I was like, well. So I asked, I said, well, can we go downstairs into the kitchen? Would it be okay if I come show you how to do it? And he was like, of course, you know. So we went down there. And just to find the right oil was a challenge. They had two oils. One was a
sesame oil.
Can't make gumbo with sesame oil or olive oil.
No. So then they have one that called. It was called their salad oil, but I looked on the back and it was actually canola oil. I was like, canola oil or vegetable oil. So I grabbed that one. So I'm actually making a dark, dark roux with a salad oil, which is weird, but it really wasn't. I don't know why that was called their salad oil, because our salad oils here are different.
Uh-huh.
But we showed them how to do it.
And it turned out beautifully. It was crazy, and I still talk about this. Like that night, I was blown away. I said, we could not speak their language. And they could not speak English. But whenever we all got into that kitchen, we barely had to use a translator. Because our body language just read what normal chefs' body language read.
Yeah, like, I need a spoon, or I need this, or whatever. And they're kind of looking around.
They knew
what you need.
It was a beautiful thing. It was kind of like,
but their face, their faces, when we were stirring, and I mean, I'm getting that really dark. And they were like, their eyes were so big. They were like, what is he doing?
You know? Right.
Cody, I don't know how to tell you this, but I've done that same thing in the Midwest and the Northwest and had them react the same
way. They freak out.
You don't have to go to Japan to freak people out over the color of roux.
No.
And I think that's the main problem. People can't really cook gumbo around the world is because they're so scared to get that dark. That or they cook it too fast and burn it and then it doesn't taste good or whatever.
Well, I recently learned that okra is pretty prevalent in Japan.
Yeah, it was everywhere.
What else went into your Japanese gumbo?
We were able to find some good crabs there, not many, and then some beautiful shrimp. But we actually had to fly over some shrimp as well, too, so make our base for our big dinner, yes, on the last night.
And another thing we learned was the seasoning over there. We asked for a Cajun seasoning, and then we broke out all the ingredients in that so we could make our own. So the first restaurant we went to, the Cajun seasoning they had, they told us it was Cajun, but when we tasted it, the back of your tongue got like a little cumin or like chili powder flavor in it.
Yeah, no,
no.
It was cumin. It was cumin. Yeah,
yeah,
it was cumin.
I know, but the way like, that's not taste.
That's not supposed to be in there. So then we had to like make our own and like build our own seasoning and kind of give them another recipe. But it worked out. And it was whenever we went to the Skeegee Fish Market and to see the seafood they have in that place. And even on the outskirts, like the people making bonita flakes. And when you said okra, they had one vendor designated to all things okra. And he pickled them and dried them and did okra chips. Like anything you could do with okra, this man did it in that little shop. And it was just beautiful because in Japan, you just like they do in Louisiana, every ingredient has a purpose and they're going to do as many things with it as they can.
So you got the okra gumbo right.
Mm-hmm.
What was the reaction when they ate it?
So they don't get really excited like us. They don't cheer. They don't express if they love something a lot. They kind of just, they're themselves.
They're very reserved.
It's hard. It's hard to tell if they like it or not. So she came up with a plan to loosen them up, and I'll let her tell you.
We were on a big stage. It was the Brand USA stage, and our interpreter was kind of, after the first time we did our presentation, he was like, you know, it's okay that they're not that lively. That's the Japanese way. And I was like, no, we're not going to settle for that. We got to get these people riled up. So we had tons of Mardi Gras beads with us. And so we decided to teach them how to say, show me something, mister.
No, throw me.
throw me something, mister. That's you. You can show me something if you want to. And they just lost it. Like, they started throwing their kids up in the air and, like, you know, making a big ruckus. It was crazy. And we're throwing beads at all these people. And, I mean, we're surrounded by other countries in their booths. So Egypt's over here looking at us like, what they got going over in the United States area of this convention? Yeah. It was crazy.
So we had a party, and then we would feed them the gumbo after that.
And then they tasted the gumbo.
And they
so they can't slurp it at the bowl because there's too much chewing going on.
Well, they had
so
some
happened?
Of them have their own chopsticks, so they like whip those out and they kind of help shovel it in.
Yeah,
to their
that's
mouth.
Exactly.
Like,
how they're kind of holding it up to their mouth and kind of scooping it in.
And because gumbo in Louisiana is called gumbo, in Japan, our interpreter kept calling it gumbo soup, and Cody's like, "No, it's gumbo. It's not a soup. It's a gumbo." And a lot of them would compliment
soups and blood.
Whenever he would translate back to us what they were saying about the gumbo, they would all compliment how deep the dashi flavor is. Which
when there was no dashi,
no,
there's
that's
no
what
dashi
they,
in it. But
that's what they call there.
It's like a seafood soup, like a
so
fish soup.
Yeah,
the translator was having trouble translating words that we use here. So when he would translate them, it would come out like that. Like the only thing he could compare it to was dashi. So he'd say it's like a dashi kind of thing.
But what it really was your deep, deep, deep shrimp stock
flavor.
That's
what they were tasting. But for them to say that and really say how different it was, because you would watch them take the first sip and then their eyes would light up kind of like with a question, like, what is this I'm eating? And then they go for another sip and then they all kind of nod and then they just down it and finish the rest of it. So it was definitely something to bring them that they've never had before.
One little short story, there was a... We hosted the gumbo cook-off, and it was five restaurants from around Tokyo. And we were judging that at that big convention, and one stood out. I mean, it was just a hands-down, across-the-board, a winner. And when the guy gets there, the chef gets there, we literally asked him, look, I mean, I know you've either tasted real gumbo, you've been to Louisiana, something. You didn't just happen to stumble upon this kind of flavor. And he said that he used to listen to jazz and Zydeco music, and he would hear the singers talking about gumbo and telling stories about gumbo. It inspired him to travel to New Orleans, come here and learn how to make it, and went back to Tokyo and opened up a place called Gumbo Kitchen Shu.
His name was Shu.
And he, I mean, he cleaned house in the competition.
What was the worst?
Somebody watched the Disney video.
Oh,
and put quinoa in it. It was so bad.
Well, I am so glad that you all were chosen to be our Louisiana ambassadors to Japan.
We were honored to go.
It was amazing.
Well, congratulations on all the wonderful things in your lives, and please come back and talk to us again on Louisiana Eats.
We will. We love it here. We love you, Poppy.
Award-winning restaurateurs, Cody and Samantha Carroll.
That's the way every day goes. Every time we've no control. If the sky is pink and white, if the ground is black and yellow, just the same way you showed me. Showed me. You showed me love.
Michael Galata, recognized by Food & Wine magazine in 2016 as one of America's best new chefs, hosts a celebration at his mid-city restaurant, MoFo, every weekend. Out on the restaurant's patio is a huge fire pit where he roasts a whole hog on a spit suspended over an open flame. The whole process takes so many hours that no one gets a taste of the pig until Saturday. But Michael invited us to join him at the Smoky Pit on Friday to see just how he does it.
This is Michael Galata, chef partner of MoFo Restaurant in Mid-City, New Orleans, and today we are doing our weekly hog roast.
Let's start at the beginning. Where does this hog come from?
We get our hogs from two different places, either Home Place Pastures, which is an open-range farm, and then the other one is Chapapila Farms, which is actually really close, right on the north shore of the lake in Husser, Louisiana.
What's the average weight on this hog when you get it in?
So we found the sweet spot is between 75 and 85 pounds. It's just right to where you get a good yield off the hog, you get a whole lot of skin, but it's not so big to where it has to cook too long and it gets dry. Because at some point, the hog is gonna be there for way too long just to get it cooked all the way to the bone, to make it tender and the meat can get dry. Whereas with an 85 pound hog, it's just perfect. By the time it's done all the way in the middle, the outside's still juicy. There's a really good fat to meat ratio. And we just find it's the, I don't know, it's just the fattiest, most delicious hog when it's done.
Walk us through the process.
It's a 3-day process. We get them in and so we rub them down with a mixture of sugar, salt, and Korean red pepper flake. And then we load it into a cooler and cover it with bags of ice. And so it basically cures overnight. So that it's basically like brining it, like a dry brine or a dry rub. So that sugar and that salt really act on the skin and the meat and really flavor it. And then the next day we rinsed all the salt and sugar off the skin. We left it on the inside because we rubbed the body cavity down too. We left all that's all fine. But that skin, because we want to fry that skin later.
Yeah.
And if we leave that salt and that sugar on that skin, it'll be really salty when you fry it. It won't be edible. So we rinse all that sugar and salt off or wipe it off. Load them onto the rack, onto the pit by 9 a.m. It'll roast all day Friday. We used to roast it overnight on Saturday night, on Friday night to Saturday morning.
But that's too hard for you to stay up all night.
Well, we started having like a lottery where one cook would have to stay. But we started coming back and finding like parties, like beer cans everywhere. So they were inviting all their friends over. And at first we were kind of okay with that, but then it got a little crazy. So the pig parties got out of hand. So now the pig gets roasted on Friday and then we let it rest. Because we pull it off late Friday night and let it rest until Saturday morning, and then we pick the whole pig for the reason of we want you to get a little bit of shoulder, a little bit of belly, a little bit of a backstrap, a little bit of a ham, because all those different parts have different moisture levels and different textures.
You know, visuals on the radio are tough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people who think about seeing a pig roasting, it's sort of like there's that little round pig and he's going round and round.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you've got the pig flayed. Why is it done that way?
It cooks faster, for one, and a little more evenly. We don't have a continuous rotating spit, so usually when they wrap them up like that, it's because they continually rotate. These pigs are a little too big for that. The rack itself weighs 30 pounds. So 35 pounds, and so when you strap an 85-pound pig to that, suddenly you got a really heavy pig that a motor is, you have to have a big motor to turn it slowly.
It's a workout for the cook.
Well, yeah, so for us, we flay it like that, so we can just, every 30 minutes or so, we just come turn it 180 degrees.
How did you learn how to do this, Michael?
We taught ourselves. And I say we because, at MoFo, it's a kitchen of guys and girls that I really love and trust, and we're busy, so there's no real one person that can sit out here and tinker with it. So we've all kind of traded off and thrown in our own ideas. Like now now we do a rub on it with coconut oil, ginger, garlic, lemongrass that we grind it all up in the blender and then brush it on as the pig roasts.
Oh.
People are always like, oh, what do you know? They try to ask all the particulars, and we don't really have particulars. We're like, oh, how hot do you keep it? I'm like, well, we put our hand between the flame and the pig, and if it hurts, it's hot enough. That's what we figure. That's kind of the way we do it. So we're not overly technical.
You have this great experience where you can eat the whole pig and all the various parts that you mix up, but there's got to be some pig leftovers. What do you do with that?
There are no pig leftovers. The bones we use the bones to make our pork pho, which we serve, and then which is a special every week, and then the head gets turned into the head cheese that you can get in the pho. The feet go to our dogs.
Lucky dogs.
Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for letting us come out here on the patio and participate in the pig roast.
I'm just glad you're interested in the pig roast.
Well, we're gonna have to eat.
Please do.
Okay.
After the whole hog rested overnight, we joined Michael again on Saturday morning in Mofo's kitchen for a taste.
So after that pig comes off the spit, what does he do? He comes in and he rests for a while?
He does. He rests so that way when we break him apart, all the juices are back in the meat. Because if we pick him apart while he's really hot off, all that juice will just pour right out and we'll lose it.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. So then we take all the bits and pieces. The back strap and the shoulders and the belly and the leg, and we cut it all up. We mix it all together. That way you get a little bit of everything. And then when you order it, it's going to go onto the griddle, and it's going to get all delicious and caramelized, and we're going to add coconut milk, and we're going to add lemongrass and ginger and garlic and chili.
Yum.
All right? Yeah. So we're going to do that right now. A little oil on our griddle. You know, the back strap's a little more tender, whereas the shoulder's a little more fatty, and of course the belly's very fatty. And so when you put all these pieces together, that's when you get something really special, because you get a little bit of all that, different textures. Of course, it's been smoking for 10 hours, so it's got that nice smokiness to it. But it's also, we cure it with a little bit of sugar, so it's also got some nice sugars in there that naturally caramelize when we put them on the griddle. So you get these nice little charred, crunchy, sweet, caramelized bits.
Yeah.
And then, to make it really delicious, we put a little bit of lemongrass, ginger, and garlic. We call that the love, the Mofo love. In another lifetime, I ran a French restaurant, and everything had shallot, garlic, and thyme in it. But here at Mofo, we do garlic, ginger, and lemongrass. And it pretty much goes in everything we make. So once we have some nice caramelization going, then comes the secret ingredient, coconut milk. Steeped with chili flake. And so that coconut milk, since we're throwing it onto this hot griddle, it's gonna really quickly reduce down and get really dark and rich. And it's gonna pick up all the little bits of caramelized pork that were on the griddle. And then we have this really beautiful color going on, and the flavor is just delicious. All right. Next, we take the skins and we drop them right in the fryer. So it's fun having a kitchen we can cheat, because traditionally, at the very end of the hog roast, you would really put a whole lot of fire on, a whole lot of wood on the fire, and let that intense heat make the skin into crackling on the pig. But, you know, we got a bunch of deep fryers, so it comes out much more puffed and delicious when you just drop it into 360-degree grease. So delicious caramelized pork. On a nice big mound on the plate, all the reduced coconut milk over the top. Top it with a big piece of crispy crackling. And then we have our house pickles. And it changes the time of year. In the winter, there'll be cauliflower in there. And we do a spicy curry pickle. And then our nok cham, traditional Vietnamese dipping sauce. It's fish sauce, garlic, jalapenos, a little vinegar, sugar, and then our beautiful pieces of roti, which we just fold up, place right next to it. You can hear them kind of crunching and being delicious. And then we do what we call it our pig herbs. Cilantro, mint, basil, and then when in the summer when we have it, we do purple perilla, which is also called shiso. And that is our pork platter.
Michael Galata, chef partner at MoFo. What creates those trails of bubbles in your champagne flute? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally slow roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What creates those trails of bubbles in your champagne flute? When you pop a champagne cork, yeast-fermented sugar form carbon dioxide gas, producing the effervescence that makes the champagne cork pop. But what about those mysterious gas trains, the tiny beads of rising air that give champagne its sparkle as they bubble to the surface? You're not going to believe this, but scientists at the University of Reims, France, discovered that tiny gas pockets and fibers stuck on the inside of a glass from dust or a towel used for drying influence the timing of the bubble trains. Fibers entrap a tiny air pocket when champagne is poured. Then, this tiny air pocket literally sucks the dissolved carbon dioxide. The gas bubbles grow inside the fibers, detaching from them once they reach the tip of a fiber. Go ahead and experiment with this phenomena at home. To add more fizz to a flute, wipe a glass with great zeal to leave behind extra fibers. Or if you prefer a calmer toast, air dry glasses upside down. Happy New Year and cheers from all of us at Louisiana Eats. As the clock turns to midnight on New Year's Eve and the music cues Auld Lang Syne, the next sound we usually hear is the pop of a champagne bottle. After all, champagne is essential to any New Year's celebration. For the finer points on this festive favorite, we spoke with the always effervescent, award-winning sommelier, Molly Wismeyer. Molly explained to us how champagne works its bubbly magic on any and all special occasions. So, Molly,
yes.
Today we're going to celebrate with champagne.
My favorite.
And you just came home from Champagne recently, because champagne, for
yes,
people who don't know, is a place as well as a sparkling wine.
As a drink, that's correct. I did. I'm very fortunate to come back from Champagne recently. It's a place of discovery, because most people think, oh, champagne, it's bubbles, it's for special occasions. But what's really exciting is when you see the landscape and the rolling hills and the beautiful greenness of it and the small, quaint churches that are in the small villages that were part of the history of the grapes themselves as well. You realize that it also is this artisanal wine, that it's not only for special occasions. It's something that can make you feel better when you haven't had a great day. It's a drink that when you want to just pop open a bag of Doritos, and yes, I just said a bag of Doritos.
Champagne and Doritos.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I love your pairings. So who did you meet in Champagne that left a big impression on you?
I was fortunate enough to visit the caves of Madame Veuve Clicquot and hear her story. I know everybody thinks, oh, Yellow Label, Veuve Clicquot. But what's really significant is that she was a woman and she decided to keep the business, and not only keep the business, but make it thrive. And really, her discovery of the riddling system, the wood, piece of wood with the holes where you see pictures of bottles with their necks pointed into it and turning the bottles so that sediment, you know, could turn, was vastly important for the nature and the style of champagne. And that is a, you know, hundreds of thousands of bottles production, but artisanal, you know, champagne. So
and Madame Clicquot is the one who figured that out?
Yes.
And you said she made the decision to keep the business.
Yes.
Because for those who don't know, she's the widow Clicquot.
That's exactly right. Veuve means widow.
Well, that was a big deal and certainly a big, big champagne producer. Who are some of the smaller people, the smaller houses that you got to visit?
Well, the first one I'd really like to talk about is called Collard Picard. We arrived the day of harvest, and this gentleman, Olivier Picard, he met with us. He took the time and gave us a tour, starting with his press, the first pneumatic press. And that's important because of the way that it crushes the grapes and does not touch the skins at all. So the ultimate beautiful juice he starts with. So he showed us the press. He showed us his barrels. Each one of those things that I just mentioned might sound like a lot of, oh, why is she telling us about this? But each choice that a winemaker decides on puts a different end result in the bottle.
Well, you brought a treat along to the Louisiana Eats studio with you today. Tell us about this very special bottle that you've arrived here with.
So what I brought to studio today, Champagne Giselle de Vavre. This is a Blanc de Blanc Cuvée Marianne. The Blanc de Blanc means white from white. What that means in Champagne is 100% Chardonnay. Now, the reason I like it is because of these beautiful high-toned citrus notes that come through. And what do I mean by high-toned? I mean, in your mouth, it's right up. It tickles the top of the roof of your mouth. That's where all most of the sensation comes from. A Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier can be, we say, a little bit more heavier, fuller. And then you feel that more weighted on your tongue. Intense minerality, but lots of layers of citrus. When you really get to savor it, really great wines, not just some champagne, you'll sit there and you'll have to think for just a moment because it will hit you that powerful. It'll still be lingering in your mouth.
Well, we've got the time and we've got the champagne. So no time like the present.
There are 6 twists on a champagne. So I'm going to look at you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Voila. And it's open. When we're in the studio with Poppy and we're celebrating and it's New Year's Eve and the joy of champagne, we're going to get a good pop out of this. We should. All right, let's see. There we are.
Oh, that was lovely.
Now, you hold the bottle just like this and see how it's starting. And see, the bubbles are at the top and I can see them. And now I can see that they've stopped running up to the top. And now I know I can go up just like that and nothing is overflowing.
Here's to you, Molly Wismeyer.
Here's to you, Miss Poppy.
Walk us through how we should be tasting this champagne.
Champagne is a lot like wine. You want to start with, you know, how does it look? Observe the color. And here we're looking at a golden champagne. And what can the color tell you? The color can tell you, has it seen oak? And what grapes does it come from? And we've got a golden color here. And I do know that the champagne does see a little bit of oak. And it also happens to be Chardonnay. Chardonnay is one of the classic grapes that can cast this hue of yellow golden. Other grapes will cast a lighter color. Then you want to smell it. You want to put your nose in there, smell it. It's like, what do you smell? For me, I smell this beautiful lemon and citrus, but then I smell chalky, dusty minerality that comes from the soil of Champagne, which is Kimmeridgian soil, a former seabed.
And to me, it has the scent of festivities past. It smells like a party to me.
It does smell like a party. And your smell is 95% of what you taste. So for me, what I like to talk about and what I like to share with people is today what wine does when you have a chance, if you get to have that bottle of wine at night, be it red, white, sparkling, whatever it is you're partaking in, it allows you to slow down for those few minutes and then use your senses, your sight, your smell, your taste, and really just go to another place. You said it makes you smell of a party. To me, it makes me smell of, okay, where did it come from? This land of champagne. You know, you get to travel to the place from where this wine comes from.
It's beautiful. Now, you mentioned Doritos, Molly, but yes. I don't really think that people are going to be rushing out to get a fine bottle of champagne and a big bag of Doritos. So would you give me some thoughts about the kinds of foods that you like to pair with champagne? You made me laugh. You said fried chicken.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Fried chicken. We did it in Chicago. We do it here in New Orleans. And it because of the crispy, beautiful breadiness that comes through and the fat and then the beautiful tenderness of the chicken, the champagne cuts through right that crunchy crisp and fat, but then marries with the succulent tenderness of the chicken because of regardless of the blend or type of champagne that you have. And it just cuts right through it and marries with it at the same time. You can have an opposing pairing or a marrying pairing. It's kind of the jargon that I'm using. So that is really fun. And it's really fun to have fried chicken and champagne parties, by the way. People love it. So that's kind of, it's classic out of the box. So let's go to a more classic pairing. Let's say it's the holidays and you're having a holiday party. You're probably going to have some cheese out. You probably have some vegetables, a cheese like brie, and that's on the softer cheese side, a little bit richer and butterier and creamier. Lemon curd is a great treat over soft or triple cream cheese. Oh my gosh, I'm telling you, with champagne. Whew. And then, you know, any kind of dips that you're going to do as well. Chips and dip, believe it or not, it goes great. And then, of course, there's the ultimate caviar.
Yes, I love your suggestion about potato chips, creme fraiche, and caviar.
Some
caviar on my potato chip,
please. And then a little squeeze of lemon. When I have a party, I'll be honest, that's what I like to do, especially around the holidays. That's what I like to do.
Well, Happy New Year, Molly
Wismeyer. Happy New Year, Poppy.
Thank you so much for sharing your life, your stories, and your fabulous bottle of champagne with us. Thank you, ma'am.
My ultimate pleasure. Happy New Year.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Award-winning sommelier, Molly Wismeyer. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Tune in next week when we visit Rodrigo Mondragon of Shreveport's Key Mexico restaurant.
You know, at the beginning, we didn't want to open a restaurant. We was like, no, that is not for us. But then, our passion changed to please people with food, of course.
On Thursday, January 12th, Louisiana Eats is teaming up with French Market Coffee for the first in a series of celebrity chef dinners to benefit the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Join us for an evening of fun and fine dining as Brennan's executive chef, Slade Rushing, prepares a three-course meal with wines paired by Bin 428. To see the menu and buy tickets, visit my website, poppytooker.com. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris.
come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.